You are listening to Max Chemthropod, the podcast organized by the Max Chem Center for the Study of Ethics, the Economy, and Social Change at the University of Cambridge. This time, research associates Rachel Smith and Scott McLaughlin speak to Caitlin Zaloom from New York University about her new book, Indebted, and the moral conflicts that inhere in and between the American family, the financial logics of the middle class, and contemporary forms of debt.
Welcome to Max Chemthropod. I'm Rachel Smith. I'm one of the postdocs in the Max Chem Center.
And I'm Scott McLaughlin, also a postdoc at Max Chem.
And we're with Caitlin Zaloom, who's Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. And we're going to be talking about a lecture you gave yesterday based on your new book called Indebted, about student debt and finance.
Which was out in September.
It's September 3rd.
September 3rd. So I was kind of, you talking last night about the moral conflicts. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what exactly is the moral conflict that's at the heart of this book.
So the basic moral conflict at the heart of Indebted is between the American values of parenting, which say that parents should do everything that they possibly can to support their children's possible futures, and the kind of constraints, on the other hand, that finance puts on the way that they might envision the future. So American families feel very committed to both of those ideas, which are in direct conflict. One is about thinking without limits. The other one is only about thinking about limits.
Great. And your previous book, your first book was On the Trading Floors, is that right, in London? And was it Chicago? And I think you were quite interested back then in ethics and financialization. And now, obviously, you're turning to the household. And I'm wondering how much continuity you saw there, like, as social scientists were sort of led to believe that capitalism's built on the separation of the market and the home, and we think of the market as this domain of like masculine, competitive, maybe even greed is good kind of morality, if you want to call it that, and then the home as this caring, selfless kind of mothering domain. And I'm wondering how much continuity you found in studying ethics between those domains.
So you're completely right that the opposition between a kind of market sphere and a home sphere has been the model for the way capitalism was organized from its sort of origins until, I would say, even the latter part of the 20th century. But one of the things that I'm interested in with financialization now is to re-examine what the relationship is between the market and the household. So I did write my first book all about professional market spaces. I mean, derivatives traders are some of the most kind of exaggerated market actors, or, you know, they occupy a very exaggerated position within these markets as being kind of competitive individuals. And I wanted to see how the pressures of understanding how people should act in economic exchange that take models from the marketplace then put pressure on the home and in effect reshape what is happening inside the home. But what I found was actually much different than what I expected, because there's a very clear line within anthropology and other related fields, which is about what sometimes goes under the banner of neoliberalism does to the household, which is that it creates individuals, it sets people against each other, they become sort of the tenders of their own human capital, which they then bring to the marketplace. But that is actually not in any way what I found inside the home. And I think that vision that the market A says does what its ideology says it's going to do. We should know as anthropologists that is suspect, mm-hmm. right? We should know that these kind of formulated articulations that come from fields like economics and human capital theory don't really do what they say they're going to mm-hmm. do. So what I found was that the pressures of finance inside the household actually ended up reinforcing the dependence between parents and children mm-hmm. and on other family members in ways that were very surprising.
So that's what I'm kind of interested in. Do you see the contemporary forms of debt that you're studying with families and student debt in universities? Do you see this as kind of it's part of the same story as your work with traders? Like it's the same financial logic that's at work, or do you think it's sort of shifted in the last decade? Like, is there something different to the kind of overarching financial logic that's at play, or is this sort of part of the same story?
Mm-hmm. Well, I very much see it as part of the same okay. story. And it works out in different ways,
right.
of course. But the idea behind many of these kind of household finance policies that I track, particularly with student debt, is that individuals should take on more risk and become more like the market actors mm-hmm. that I studied in derivatives markets, you know, who themselves worked very hard at presenting their own work as incredibly competitive, incredibly autonomous. So that has a similar kind of root in a marketplace ideology. But you know, inside the family, it does something very different, in part because the reasons for engaging in financial practices from the point of view of parents or young adults is just very, very different. So in derivatives markets, traders are trying to make money. It's not really anything more than that. I mean, they're competing for status as well, but those are two very continuous sorts of goals. But in a family, they're trying to build relationships, and they're looking at long-term intergenerational horizons, which are very, very different than the kind of very short-term self-oriented goals from within the marketplace.
Hmm. On the other hand, I mean, something that I find really interesting in your book, because it spoke to our center, so we're Center for Ethics, Economy and Social Change. Some of us are coming back from a more traditional economic anthropology background, and as we know, economic anthropology has been really good at sort of showing how important moral obligations are, kinship ideals, how productive this idea of debt and owing each other things are, and ideas about the future. On the other hand, there's this, also at Cambridge emerging, this kind of argument that there's been too much focus on morality and constraints, and that actually we need to look at ethics as kind of freedom and self-cultivation. And mm-hmm. I think something I found really interesting in your book, even though you've written it not for necessarily an anthropological audience, is actually you show how those two ideals, how this ideal of self-cultivation is so important in what's motivating parents to actually enter into these constraints, and a lot of that's to do with this kind of moral obligation they feel of care towards their children. So yeah, I'm just wondering if you could speak a bit more about those productive tensions, and also, you know, there's other people who say, well, there's too much focus on moral economy and ethics of freedom, and actually we need to look at political economy and really what the big sort of you know, macro changes are in the economy, and you seem to show how all those things kind of feed off each other.
Yeah, that's a very clear goal of mine. Mm. I think that you can't actually address any of those pieces without addressing the others as an anthropologist. I mean, if you're an anthropologist, you have to understand the political economy in which you're in which the people that you work with operate. Those are the conditions of their lives, and oftentimes, a political economy in which people operate set the problems that they face. So in terms of you know, getting kids to college and the student debt and other forms of kind of financial activity, it requires, I mean, that problem is set forth by the political economy, specifically of the United States, and its kind of longstanding tensions between state provision of public goods like colleges and universities and this other kind of countervailing political morality, which says that individuals should really do for themselves, which is a tension that exists throughout American history. I mean back to the kind of origins of the American welfare state. It's never one or the other around that kind of politics. And for anthropologists, it's never ethics or some kind of constraint, whether it's political, economic, or moral. It is both of those things always. The challenge, I think, for us is learning how to tell stories that put those things together. And I really set out and indebted to do all three. Mm-hmm. But doing that is a really substantial challenge, because it's not only a conceptual challenge, because you have to, in fact, have enough mastery over each of those domains, but you also have to be able to tell the story of their articulation. And it also means giving up the idea that you're going to participate in some camp in anthropology that is rah-rah one or the other.
Sure, yeah.
And talking of articulation, something else I found really interesting, you drew on feminist thought to show how, you know, I think Marx mentioned that the home is the domain of reproduction, but feminists really shifted the perspective from the workplace to the home in terms of how that keeps capitalism functioning. But I was really interested in this idea that in this financialized world that we're in now, how this is shifting into certain ideas of social speculation, I think you call it. I wondered if you could explain.
Yes, so I draw on Polanyi's notion, actually, of fictitious commodities to kind of hinge between the work on social reproduction that really flowered in feminist ideas, feminist economic ideas, and a new idea of social speculation that I'm wanting to develop. So within the financial economy, the bonds of family love become something that was produced outside the market that then becomes its own source of value within the market. So quite literally, people are taking on loans and then paying interest over many, many years in order to honor their love of their children, on the one hand, and then also on the young people's part, their desire to become the sorts of people that will make their families proud and also kind of win them a position within an American society that really requires them to be middle class in order to earn respect. So those kinds of values, which are extra market values, are incredibly important in financial capitalism. So I think that we need to really take account of that. But that also means that both parents and young people alike are put in the position of speculation. They have to be paying money today and for many years too, before they might even possibly have a kind of payoff. So that's also about a change in the structure of capitalism. So where feminist economic thinkers of the kind of 60s, 70s, 80s were having a reference to industrial capitalism and social reproduction as a kind of churning out of families and workers to support that in a bit of a mechanistic way that parallels the form. In financial capitalism, there's another component to it. So it's not like it supersedes social reproduction, but it loads speculation on top of that critical function.
So one thing I wanted to ask was this. So I've always been fascinated with this kind of hard-worn image of the kitchen table. I think even there's 1990s ads that the Harry and Louise ads that against Bill Clinton's healthcare legislation. So this is, I think a series of ads actually, I think, by the Republican Party. But again, you see this image of like the two parents strategizing about their finances at the kitchen table. But what it highlights is these forms of privacy that exist within, or that are seen to exist within the family kind of setup. But it's this widely circulated and very public version of this particular type of privacy. And you talk about, and what I'm kind of interested in is, do you see these types of privacies as being, of course, central to what's at play and these kind of forms of financial strategy? But how would you align that with the forms of like transparency or lack of transparency within the student debt system, but also kind of within the broader kind of financial logic that's mm-hmm. going on? I'm wondering, did you see them at play with each other, or they're just kind of separate?
I think that's an interesting question. So the kitchen table has that place for a reason. And so, you know, when I would go interview people, where would we sit except at their kitchen table? You know, and they would literally like take out forms to show me, or, you know, we would have this intense discussion over coffee. It really is a place inside the home where people have discussions, which is why it works.
Yeah.
As a kind of political statement, what do people do? They do it at their kitchen table. That's where they discuss the most important things. It's the kind of heart of the household. So the symbolics are kind of true to experience or at least as I found them in my research, for sure. Those forms of privacy are incredibly important for the sort of politics that we have around the financial economy, because what happens at the kitchen table often stays at the kitchen table. So the question is kind of like, how do you move from those intimate spaces of discussion where, you know, in a kind of idealized marriage, Harry and Louise are actually talking to each other about everything that's happening. You know, that's not always the case. I mean, especially if you take into account the fact that most marriages in the U.S. end in divorce. So at some point, Harry and Louise really do stop talking altogether. So it is, of course, very, very idealized. The couple is not necessarily as transparent as that would present. I think that one part of it that's very interesting is that the idea of middle class privacy is something that almost everyone that I spoke to for Indebted defended very instinctively. So it wasn't even that it was part of the part of an explicit discussion, say, where families would like, well, I would like to, you know, talk to you about my finances, but I feel so uncomfortable doing that. I mean, really, it was very, very difficult in part to even do the study that I did, because it's so intense. And that barrier meant that they would want, I mean, families just want to keep outsiders out, including even friendly professors who have taught their kids and won their trust.
But did you actually find that the crisis that they find themselves in oftentimes, did that help them or help you kind of access it? Or did it want to be more private or less private because of these stresses and pressures?
Yeah, generally more private.
More private.
And that's one of the paradoxes of it, is that in crisis, families kind of double down on on this privacy idea, in part because their status is threatened. So as the American middle class is kind of squeezed and squeezed and eroded, that silence about family finances actually becomes strengthened, because it's the last place where people can feel they're defending their status. I mean, things might be going terribly, terribly wrong, but their independence is intact if they're not talking about it with outsiders, and if they're not acknowledging all of the help that they need and which they often reach for.
Mm. So that builds onto something else I wanted to ask, because this value on silence, or at least this practice of silence, and this value on autonomy and the idea that the home should be responsible, seems to prevent, like, it's hard to see the political possibilities of how, say, middle class families, like a kind of a class consciousness in terms of how they are being squeezed and how you know, how they can act politically to change the system. On the other hand, we have seen people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders really highlighting this issue. So I was curious if you could speak to political possibilities and also how you think these households map onto, say, a left-right politics. Did you see a spectrum? Mm-hmm. Do you think middle-class parents are likely to shift left because of, say, Sanders or Warren, or is that much more aimed at a kind of the kids in college now, and you don't, you know, that, yeah, so I suppose if you could speak to that.
Yeah, so I think that what's happening politically now is very, very interesting, because, in fact, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are asking people to identify as debtors, which essentially is a kind of coming out of the closet, because of the silence imposed. So it's structurally, it feels similar. It's something held privately that has a lot of shame attached to it, that these politicians are asking people to identify with politically so that there can be change around it. And I think that that's very, very interesting. And I think that there is some movement around it. I think particularly people who are now in their 20s and 30s may be able to do that in a way that their parents or people who are slightly younger than their parents are going to have a much harder time in kind of breaching that boundary.
Yeah. So I think that's like really important, is to kind of say that like the ethics around debt is kind of being highlighted, right? Or the morality, if you see it. But within, whether it's Warren or Sanders or whoever, do you think that they are understanding finance in similar ways to you? Do you think there's a shift toward that, or do you still think there's a kind of a fundamental misreading? Because I'm like myself, coming more from kind of a study of corporations, and kind of Elizabeth Warren and a couple of people are thinking about like the need to redesign the corporation and its kind of place within, say, the US or kind of global economy. I would still be very critical of how they're actually framing what the corporation is, but I would definitely see that they're moving more towards something that I think, say, in the anthropology of corporations would align with. Would you find that, or do you think they're kind of they're still misreading?
I think that the sources are quite continuous in a way. I mean, so one of the kind of really important pieces of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders' programs has been the debt collective and strike debt that came out of the Occupy movement. So a lot of activists who did work around eradicating debt in the wake of Occupy, like, for instance, buying up debt on the secondary market and eradicating it, because you can buy it on, you know, pennies on the dollar. I mean, those kinds of strategies really highlighted the ways that debt was being used as a tool of basically of oppression, and those kind of activist strategies were really powerful at highlighting what the problem with debt as we have it arranged today, and they've all, and the debt collective has also been very focused on things like predatory private colleges, which also throw students into debt. So, and they're just very involved in the kinds of strategies that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are now making very, very much mainstream. And there are plenty of participants in the debt collective who are our colleagues. So we should, we should figure out, what the common roots are, because I think they're very much there.
And so just a quick question, maybe the whole discourse within kind of U.S. universities themselves and within academia is that the neoliberalization of universities. And so I'm just wondering, does your work, I don't know if you can answer this, but do you think that the universities are victims of this logic, or are they, of course they're perpetuating it. Do you think they're willfully perpetuating these forms of debt and these kind of these logics, or are they victims to it?
Yeah. So I think the story is always more complicated than the neoliberalization of anything.
Right. Yeah.
So that, I think that idea that there is one monolithic movement of kind of corporatization and individuation and competitive individualism within universities is, I'm not denying that that's there. It is there, but it's one strand, and it is not monolithic. And so I think as anthropologists, it's our job to understand what the competing strands are, and then what that competition produces. So, for instance, in American universities, particularly public ones, there has been decades of cuts that public universities have faced from state legislatures simply kind of hacking away at their budgets for one reason or another. So they have to get their operational funds from somewhere in order to actually educate the students who they are committed to educating, which means that they in fact have to raise tuition. And so there's an interesting kind of Republican strategy that happens within state legislatures, which is that on the one hand, you squeeze the university hard enough so that they have to raise tuition, and then you wait for the Democratic outcry about that students are being asked to pay too much. That's a strategy. Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say that universities are innocent in this. They are not. But I think that when we talk about the neoliberalization of the university, we should think about it within a broader kind of political landscape than we usually do, because also universities are our workplaces. We should recognize that we are all participants in them, and as far as I'm concern, my colleagues and I are not particularly interested in producing competitive individuals. That might be a structure in which we operate, but also the way we teach our classes and the resistance that we put up is just as much part of the university as those neoliberal pressures. And so if we just say that there's this kind of monolith that's coming for all of us, we are simply denying our own agency, which is a lovely and very easy position to take, but it also denies our own responsibility in a way.
Thanks. I think we're almost out of time. But I suppose, given the political moment and the attention on this, and it seemed very timely with the College Admissions scandal as well. So I know the book's received a lot of attention very widely and been in some major newspapers and major broadcasting networks, and it's written in a very highly engaging, readable way as well, which I think facilitated that. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about anthropology and the social sciences, perhaps more generally, what your hopes for in terms of engaging a wider public and how we should do that, either in sort of selection of the kinds of research that we do or how we communicate that. And I know you also have a website, Public Books, as well, where you promote kind of public communication of research as well.
That's right, so, yes. I'm obviously very committed to this idea. I mean, you know, I think also because, you know, I did my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. You know, I came out of an institution that which is fundamentally a public mission, even though Berkeley and the University of California has been one of the places that have faced the budget cuts that I was just mentioning very, very heavily. I actually just learned that not Berkeley, but UCLA now gets less than 7% of its budget from the state of California. I mean, that's not really a state university in the way that we used to think about it at all. But
it used to be ish, like 30 years ago. Was it?
The cuts really started ramping up about 30 years ago. But you know, so you would have to go back to the 1960s to understand really what that budget looked like. But you know, 7% is extremely low. I'm not quite sure why I got off on that track, but that mission for kind of taking scholarship into the public realm and understanding that we actually have a responsibility to the people who fund our work, I mean, including our students, to try to connect with the issues of the day that really concern them. I think that that's incredibly important. So, you know, so one thing that I think about a lot is what does it mean to be a public scholar? How do you create a base for yourself within scholarship, within a kind of deep investigation that not only is empirically rigorous, but is also conceptually grounded and thoughtful, and at the same time speak outward from that base. And that is something that I really set out to do with Indebted, and which Public Books also represents. And, you know, in Public Books, I have people writing who've never written for a public audience before. So part of the mission of the magazine not only is to be a place where people can come to read about the newest scholarship in the academy and understand what is happening within it, but also as a place where younger scholars and even more senior scholars who've never written in a public register can come to, in effect, learn the craft of writing publicly. And they do that through our very intensive editorial process. And so that's the moment where you learn, for many people, how to kind of code switch between an academic register and a public one without losing your essential expertise.
Great. Thank you so much. I think we're out of time, but thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about our center and its research, sign up for our newsletter at maxcam.socanth.cam.ac.uk.